You got it pretty much right. It's Delamater. My dad always used to say it was like, "See you later, Delamater." And as cheesy as it was, it would always help. Anyway, well, thank you, Mr. Ekema, for the opportunity to speak. And it's so nice to be back here, to be able to see some familiar faces. I grew up in the L.A. area, and the Apartians were there, and knew him from way back. And we've got some good memories in this room. So it's so nice to be able to be here and to be able to see all of you, and just to be able to share some time here on this amazing Sabbath day. I want to read a little excerpt from an article this morning, or this afternoon here, that maybe isn't what we would usually read in a sermon, but it's an article from Vanity Fair about the most recent Star Wars movie that came out at the end of 2019. Have you seen the new Star Wars movie? Anybody? Some people? It's funny, we just talked about movies, and here we are. Here I am going to talk about a movie. Not so much about the movie, but, well, you'll see. In a December 21st, 2019 article, a writer named Anthony Brenzikin, he said, "There's no denying that the ninth film in the Skywalker saga has divided the vast fandom for the series. Intense and heartfelt reactions, both in favor of its story and against it, continue to emerge as more people see it." Now, it's been a little over a year since that came out, so maybe that's kind of died off. But after it first came out, there were people who were just all for it, thought it was the greatest thing, the nicest way to wrap up this 9-part saga. And then there were other people that thought it was just an atrocity, and they were just spewing all sorts of hate about it. The director, continuing in the article, he's quoting director J.J. Abrams. He says, "There is an M.O., of either it's exactly as I see it, or you're my enemy. It's a crazy thing that there's such a norm that seems to be void of nuance and compassion. And this is not a phenomenon about Star Wars, this is about everything," he said. And it's true. It's true. There's so much that we see now that is devoid of nuance and compassion, that casts things as completely black, completely white, in this corner or that corner. This polarization that we see around us is new in some ways. It's very intense in our society in a way that it perhaps hasn't been in a very long time. We're in very contentious times, right? There's all sorts of things that we contend about or could contend about, that our media certainly contends about, whether it's COVID or the impeachment or the elections. Issues abound. They're just endless. Many of us have observed in personal experience, people have observed in published articles and even in surveys and studies, that our country has become more polarized than maybe at any other time in its history short of the Civil War. You've seen people refer back to that time and think about the amount of polarization that we had in the country back then that we can read about. And we're polarized now not over one issue, not over one thing, but over everything. Everything. It's like if there's an issue that can come up, we'll divide into camps on it. We'll take an issue and we'll make it align under one of our camps, right? And we'll divide into our camps. From an article, this is from a survey that was done a little over 3 years ago called the Hidden Tribes Report. It says, "More Americans than ever perceive deep conflicts between Democrats and Republicans. Split ticket voting is at its lowest on record. Political beliefs are increasingly divided along party lines. And growing numbers of Americans are expressing extreme distrust of members of other political groups and of governmental institutions." And so in our politics especially, we see the division. But we see a lot of things falling into those same alignments because of the politics. This sermon, though, is not about politics. It's not about politics or elections or voting. It's not about movies. It's about polarization, because polarization is not limited to politics. It's not just isolated to that particular playground. Polarization has many playgrounds. Right? It can play out in the politics. It can play out in the news. It plays out especially in social media. It plays out in personal interactions. Right? Social media is sort of just a platform for extremists to get in and generate issues, to draw people into their thinking, or to repel people, as more often happens, from their particular point of view. Polarization is a human problem. It's a part of human nature. So it's not, in that sense, it's nothing new. It's heightened now, perhaps, but polarization, our tendency as humans to become very, very aligned with particular points of view, is just part of our nature. It's just a human problem. If you think about it in terms of magnetics, right, the idea of polarization sort of connects with magnetics, that the way that a magnet works is that the molecules within a particular piece of metal become aligned in a particular direction. Right? And then you have poles. You have a north and a south pole, and those two poles will attract each other and whatnot. But the thing that creates that magnetic field is the alignment of the molecules within a particular, or the atoms within a particular substance. And polarization really is about alignment. It's about alignment into opposing factions most of the time, taking a worldview that is us versus them. But it's about alignment. It's about aligning our particular way of thinking with some predefined way of thinking, with somebody's, you know, their view that they're advocating or espousing. The year behind us was one that was full of polarizing messages. You can think about it in all the different contexts. And you think about this coming year, it's probably still going to be full of plenty more polarizing messages. We still have a lot of the same issues really at play that we did a year ago. COVID is still a thing, and it's still causing people to have split views on all sorts of stuff. We have another impeachment that is driving all sorts of different views on things. We have a new president, and of course, everything he does is going to be scrutinized, and people are going to align under all of those different things. And who knows what other movies will come out that people will decide that they need to make camps on and align under, right? There's all the things that people could align under. So let's talk today, let's look a little bit at polarization, because the Bible has plenty to say about it. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians. Let's start in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 18. The context here is that Paul is writing the church in Corinth about the Passover meal, about the way that they were observing the Passover. And he makes an observation about them when they come together. In 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 18, he says, "First of all, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and in part, I believe it." They had divisions that were probably class divisions. A lot of the commentators think that these were class divisions based on the wealthy and the poor who were dividing. But there were these divisions among them that were creating these poles, that were creating these camps within the church. In verse 19, he said, "For there must also be factions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you." He said, this is not something new. And he says, this is going to happen in the church. And of course it has. Right? The church has been a battleground where Satan has attacked repeatedly over the years. And one of the places that he likes to be able to really play on our nature is our tendency to polarize. Our tendency to align ourselves into these different camps, find an idea and latch onto that idea and make this our idea and those people are the bad ones. We have this happen a lot in the church with at least as much frequency and perhaps more frequency than it happens outside of the church. But we have committed ourselves to aligning under a different way. We've committed ourselves to aligning with God, to aligning with His way of thinking, with His way of being, with His issues, with His purposes. That's what we've committed our lives to, and that's what we've aligned behind, is God's way. How do we get there? How do we get out of this mindset of needing to align under certain things that people will throw at us and certain ideas and certain issues? How do we make sure that we stay aligned with God's issues, with God's purposes, with our calling? Because really, that's what we've decided to do. When we were baptized, we said, yes, I'm gonna put all of my things aside and I'm going to align myself with God the Father and with His thinking, with His way of being. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 9. Because Jesus Christ teaches us some very interesting things here about polarization, about how to combat it. There are three little vignettes. Let's go to Luke chapter 9 and verse 46. We'll spend most of our time here and in the parallel account in Mark. So Luke 9 and Mark 9 both cover some of these same vignettes, but there are three really short, kind of brief stories that we can read over very quickly, but they teach us so much. There's a lot that he packs in here if we start to unpack what it is that was happening behind the scenes with these stories, and we can see what he's teaching us here about how we ought to feel towards others. Because he addresses, in these three stories, we're going to see three things. He addresses rivalries within a group, and certainly the church is no stranger to that. But he talks about how to deal with rivalries that happen inside of the group. He talks about rivalries between similar groups, so one group and then this other group, and how should our group feel about this other similar group. And then, of course, he talks about rivalries with opponents, with enemies, and how should we feel towards those people when there's very clearly an us and them. He teaches us how to think about those people. Right? In all three, our human tendency is rivalry and competition. That's just our nature. That's in our blood. That's who we are as humans, and then Satan plays on that and really stirs it up. And so we can be very prone to rivalry and to competition. Dividing up between us and them. Greater and lesser. You know, who's more right? Who's righter and who's wronger? Right? But Jesus undermines that whole way of thinking. Our whole carnal human way of thinking. And he teaches us some really neat things in these three stories. Let's look at the first one. The first one starts in verse 46. Luke chapter 9 and verse 46. Now the background here, before we start reading it, this is not very long after the Transfiguration. So if you remember, the Transfiguration happened probably, they had probably been further north, up on a mountain, and Peter, John, and James, just those three, you'll remember, Peter, John, and James, they witnessed the Transfiguration. They got to see Jesus changed into something else, and they had a vision of the kingdom, and they saw Moses and Elijah, and they just wanted to stay there. They thought it was great. Now they got to see that, but just those three, not the other nine. So now they're coming down from there, and they're traveling back. They've returned to Capernaum, and they're in the house, it says. They're probably in, this is probably Peter's house, but they're in a house. And they're having this conversation. And they had been having this conversation in the road. It says in verse 46, then a dispute arose among them as to which of them would be the greatest. So there's the three that got to see the Transfiguration. And clearly, maybe there's some status going on there that, like, well, those three, they got to witness something really special and the other nine didn't. So maybe those three are the better three. So you can imagine that if you're not one of those three, maybe you know you're not the greatest. So you're, you know, sort of putting your weight behind this guy. Well, I really think Peter, I mean, Peter's kind of the guy. Well, I don't know. James is pretty good. I don't know. John's pretty good. Right? They may not have been vying for their own greatness. They might have been vying for somebody else's greatness. But there was vying for greatness. They're saying, who's going to be the best? Who's going to be number one? They understood enough about the kingdom to know that there were going to be roles, that there were going to be positions. We understand the same thing. We know that in the kingdom there will be roles, people will have positions, we won't all be doing the same thing. We understand that. And we understand that in some ways there's like this, maybe a hierarchy of sorts, right? People in charge of bigger things or lesser things, or we don't know, but we know that David's going to be ruling over Israel, and then there's rulers over smaller groups. And so we understand that there are some of those responsibilities that are distributed. And they probably understood that too. So now they're trying to figure out which role am I going to have? How great am I going to be? This is really a form of polarization, right? They're saying, well, am I better or are you better? Is my guy better or is your guy better? And now they're sort of, they're dividing up is what's happening, right? They're clearly at odds with each other. Who is the better? Who is the lesser? Who is the greater? Verse 47, Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, took a little child and set him by him. And now Jesus Christ understood not just the content of the conversation, but he understood their hearts. He understood the attitude that was happening there. And so he's going to teach them something about their attitude, about their way of thinking. He's not just going to answer their question. He's going to teach them something much deeper. And this, you think about this, this was probably a very personal move. Some of the commentaries speculate that this was not just a child off the street. He probably didn't like run out into the street and just grab some kid and pull him in and say, hey, look at this guy. This was probably one of their children. This was very likely one of the kids that was in the house. And he grabs the little child and he sets it down. So this would have been a very personal move for them. Something that all of them would have been able to relate to and to connect to. Hopefully he picked the good kid. You want the really good, not the bratty kid. But I'm sure he picked a child and he set the child among them and said, here, this is your example. Verse 48. Whoever receives this little child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives him who sent me. This is a very weird answer. Right? If they're asking who is the greatest, and here is his answer. Now, I skipped the last sentence there. I haven't read that yet. Right? But what he's done, if you just read up to that point, it's a very weird answer. They're saying, who's greatest? Who's greatest? And he sets a child there and says, whoever receives this little child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives him who sent me. He's not addressing the issue. He's refocusing them on how to think, on where their thinking really should be. For he who is least among you will be great. Whoever's least among you will be great. And that's a complete paradox. How does that make any sense? Who's least among you will be great? He says things like the last will be first. Right? When he makes those kinds of statements, he's really upending their whole way of thinking. He's saying this is not even the right question. Expositor's Bible commentary says it refers to receiving for the sake of Christ a person who has no status. So a little child in their society had no status. They were just, hopefully going to grow up one day into something, but it was not a person of status. The meaning then is that instead of seeking status for ourselves out of pride as an associate of the Messiah, which is what they were doing, we Christians should, as Jesus did, identify ourselves with those who have no status at all, welcoming them to join us in the kingdom. He's telling them to align themselves with the humble. And that's what we need to do. That's sort of our first thing that we can do to combat some of the polarization, is to align ourselves with the humble. Expositors continues, it says, the child is held up as an ideal, not of innocence, of purity, or faith, but of humility and unconcern for social status. That's what the child represents, is humility and a total lack of even thinking about greatness. The child isn't thinking about how great he's going to be in the kingdom. The child is dependent on the parent. And that's the focus that he wanted them to have. If we look at the parallel account in Mark chapter 9. Let's go over to Mark 9. It starts in verse 33. In verse 35, though, he says, he sat down, he called the 12 and said to them, if anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. Last of all and servant of all. Now, imagine if you lived in a society where that was the criteria for evaluating greatness. That's not how we evaluate greatness, right? It's very hard for most people to look at someone and evaluate greatness based on these criteria that he's laying out. That's not what we do. He's telling them that we're using these different scales. We're using different systems, different ways of weighing things. And the way that we like to weigh things as human and say, oh yes, this one's great. He says it's a completely wrong way of doing it. It's a completely wrong scale. It's a wrong system. Service, he talks about service as being the thing that is most important. Now, here's the pitfall that we can get into sometimes in that arena, I think, is that we look at service and we say, okay, service is the thing that qualifies us for greatness in the kingdom. So I'll serve now in this life. I'll put my service in so that I can have greatness in the kingdom. Right? And people have interpreted it this way. Okay, I'll put in my years of service in this life, but then when the kingdom rolls around, I'm going to have some greatness, and I'm going to have that rod of iron, and then people will get what's coming to them. And that's not what he's saying. He's not saying, okay, get your service in now so that you can be great later. He's saying service is greatness. In the kingdom of God, service is greatness. He presents them this contradiction. You know, who is the greatest? Well, the least is the greatest. I think what he's getting at is that it's a really bad question. It's just not the kind of question that the God family asks. Because really, if we think about who is the greatest, well, the Father's the greatest. Okay, that's an easy one, right? God the Father is the greatest. Jesus Christ is going to turn all authority over to the Father, and the Father is the greatest. That question is answered. Let's move on. Let's go figure other things out, right? Let's go figure out how to serve. And that's the way that the God family thinks. You don't have to turn over there. Matthew 18. He harps on this idea in multiple places. In verse 3, he says, assuredly I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Humility is so important. The disciples sort of show us here, they teach us here that you can be focused on the kingdom, really, truly focused on the kingdom, imagining the kingdom, thinking about the kingdom, and still be doing it for self-serving reasons. Thinking about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom. You are thinking about the kingdom, but you're still doing it for your own good. Jesus Christ is saying, Align yourself with the humble. Stop pursuing greatness. Stop pursuing superiority. We need to have the humility to recognize when we're wrong. To recognize that we may be wrong even when we're sure we're right. To recognize that we aren't experts on everything. To be able to point to Jesus Christ as our guy. Right? Not to James, to John, to Peter, to some human leader as our guy. That Jesus Christ is, he's our guy. Right? If we're going to point to somebody as the human that we want to align ourselves under, he's it. Let's look at the second story in Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9 and verse 49. So there, in that first, the first story, he teaches us how to avoid some of the polarization that can happen within the group, between individuals, right? Aligning under a certain person, a certain leader, greatness, whatever it is. Here he's going to address a slightly different situation. Now, the background to this, if you go back to, if you look at verse 37 in Luke chapter 9, so just a little before this, you'll read the story. This man brings his son to Jesus Christ and asks him to heal him, because he had brought him to the disciples and the disciples couldn't do it. They couldn't cast this demon out of his son. His son had a demon that would cause him to convulse and all these terrible things, and the disciples couldn't cast him out. Jesus Christ cast him out. So this is sort of fresh in their experience, right? This is kind of there in the background. Now, let's jump back down to verse 49, because here we see this same issue sort of comes up, and you could see why maybe they might be a little bit sensitive about what had happened. Luke 9, verse 49. Now, John answered him, and he said, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow with us." So they had not been able to cast out a demon in this particular case. And here now he says, well, they saw this other guy who was casting out demons, but he wasn't one of the group. They weren't sure about him, so they forbade him. They told him not to do it. Now, casting out demons only happens with God's involvement. That doesn't happen just, you know, because somebody decides they think they're going to cast out demons. We have the example over in Acts 19, where these guys come to this demon-possessed man and they say, "We exorcise you in the name of Jesus, whom Paul preaches." And so they try to go do this. We cast you out in the name of Jesus Christ. And he says, "I know Jesus and I know Paul, but who are you?" And he attacks them, and it doesn't go well for them, right? So you can't just, reciting Jesus' name is not just magic. It's not, oh, you said the magic word, now the demon's going to leave. Right? That's not how it works. Casting out demons happens with God's involvement. It cannot happen without God's involvement, because God has the authority to do that, right? We don't have the authority to do that. And just uttering his name does not mean you have the authority to do that. But if God is involved, a demon will be cast out. So they saw someone who had been casting out demons, and they forbade him. "We forbade him because he does not follow with us." Now you have this, our group, their group thing, us and this other guy who we don't know what's going on there. So we stopped him, we shut it down. They're actively opposed to people who are not part of the group that are trying to do these things that may or may not be good. They're just not sure about it. Really, they just didn't know. But their natural inclination was, we're going to shut that down. So we forbade him, he says. This is sort of an in-group, out-group mentality, as they might label it today. Right? In-group, out-group bias is something that has been studied a lot in sociological circles, and there are plenty of papers that we could read about it. But it's just a human thing. But what's really behind this concern that he does not follow with us? We don't really know. We don't have, it doesn't explain it, but we know from our own personal experiences the kinds of things that could be behind that sort of thing, right? Like sometimes we might have our own things that we have thought up, right? Not even necessarily biblical things, right? But are things that we have come to, and then it turns out there's also somebody else who's got that same idea, and they're sharing that same thing. And so then do we want to be seen as the only source of truth on this issue, and so we need to kind of forbid them? Are we afraid of being outdone by this other person who came to this same idea? Right? That maybe their idea is actually an even better version of my idea, and now I'm going to be embarrassed because somebody else actually outdid me here. There are any number of reasons that humanly we could feel like we are in competition with somebody who is doing something similar, but not exactly what I'm doing. The disciples may have believed that he needed to sort of study up under Jesus Christ, that he needed to sort of like pay his dues and be a real disciple, not just some rogue disciple. They looked to Jesus Christ to sort of validate and say, who's in the group and who's out of the group? How should we handle this? They were unclear. And we feel these same things as human. But Jesus Christ answers with a very interesting bit of instruction. Verse 50. Jesus said to him, "Do not forbid him, for he who is not against us is on our side." Now, he makes an opposite statement somewhere else. We'll get to that in a second. But think about what he's saying here. He says, "Do not forbid him, for he who is not against us is on our side." If we see something that clearly God has a hand in, right? Somebody's cast out a demon, and that only happens by the hand of God, then he says, don't forbid him. Don't feel threatened by it. If it is our God who is involved there doing that thing, we don't need to feel threatened by it. That's God's choice. God decided to work through whoever that guy was to cast a demon out. He said, don't forbid him. God is involved in that. The parallel account in Mark adds something. Let's go over to Mark chapter 9, because this, I think, is very, shows a lot about how Jesus Christ thought and how we need to think. Mark 9 and verse 39. He says the same thing. "Do not forbid him, for no one who works a miracle in my name can soon afterwards speak evil of me." Now, he said, no one who works a miracle in my name, he recognized that he was doing it through the proper authority and that God was involved. So he recognized God's involvement. But he says, no one who does this can soon afterwards speak evil of me. He recognized the impact on the individual who did it. Not only on the individual who was healed, not only on the one who had the demon cast out, but on the individual who was involved in casting out the demon. I'll tell you a quick story. I was ordained as an elder about 10 years ago, and the first time somebody came and asked me to anoint them, it was a close friend, and he had been struggling with some back issues. And so I anointed him for his back issues. And it was really neat. A week later, the following week at services, he comes up to me and he says, "Hey, just wanted you to know my back's been feeling a whole lot better." And I said, "Oh, well, that's great. I'm really glad." He said, "Yeah, I went into my doctor and my doctor said, there's no way you're feeling better. What you have takes years to figure out." And he said, No, I'm feeling better. And the doctor said, Well, we'll keep checking in on this, but I don't know. But he was feeling better, and he was fine after that. Now, that was great for him, but that had a huge impact on me. This was the first time I had anointed anybody, right? And you know that God is involved, God should be involved, but to see that God is involved and to know that, okay, well, God can work through me, that had a big impact on me as well. So Jesus Christ here is saying that when God is working through someone, it has benefits for those who receive the blessings, but it also has a significant impact on the person that God is working through. And so he says, no one who works a miracle in my name can soon afterwards speak evil of me. If you see God's hand, if you see his power, you can't turn around and then speak evil of God. You can't turn around and then work against God without searing your conscience severely. So Jesus Christ understood, he understood the impact there for everybody that was involved. He said, no, don't forbid that. Now, there are some distinctions to make here too, though. This is the view that he teaches us towards outsiders, those who are not necessarily part of your group, right, but who are out there, who are doing something that seems to be good. His teaching is, don't go shut that down. Don't try to work against that. Don't feel threatened by that. You know, if God is involved, then it will succeed. And if he's not involved, then it won't. So the Bible says very different things about insiders who do not follow with us. Right? If there are outsiders that are doing something, he says don't shut it down. Now, if there are insiders who do not follow with us in that sense, right? John came here to Jesus and said, he doesn't follow with us, but he was doing these things. Now, if we have insiders who are with us, but who then do not actually follow with us, who are not actually following what God taught, that's a whole different thing, right? So we want to make that distinction. The other distinction is, he doesn't say, let's go find that guy. Let's go follow after him and see what he's doing. He didn't encourage his disciples and say, yeah, go find that guy. Go see how he's doing this let's see how God's working through him. He didn't encourage them to go pursue it. He just said, don't forbid him. So he does make those distinctions. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 12. Here's where he seems to say the opposite thing. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 30. He says, he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters abroad. Now here he seems to sort of be making the opposite statement, right? That because what we just read was that he who is not against us is on our side. Now here he says, he who is not with me is against me. And this was also in the context of casting out demons, if you read through this story. Expositor says this about this statement. It says, Jesus did not want to force men quickly into a decision about himself. He did not want to force men quickly into a decision about himself. He desired to give them plenty of time to decide, during which the principle in Mark 9 applies, that he who is not against us is on our side. He wanted to give people time to decide about him, time to decide whether they were going to align themselves with him or not. Continuing in Expositors, it says, but when the critical moment for decision arrives, then the principle laid down in Matthew 12 takes over. He who is not with me is against me. Jesus Christ wanted to give people time to decide about him. He wanted to give people time to assess him. It's really neat that he doesn't expect people to just come to it instantly. And then make a decision in that spur of the moment. He understands that we're humans, that we take some time, that we need to figure things out. And he allows us time to do that. God takes some time to make that decision. And God ultimately has to make a decision about every individual, to be able to say about every person, as he did of Abraham, "Now I know. Now I know that you will follow." Sometimes we want to make a decision about somebody on the outside that God hasn't made yet. And that's our natural tendency. We want to see people who are, we see people who are out there who are doing whatever they're doing, and we want to make a decision saying, "Here's my judgment. I've cast my judgment now." Right? When God hasn't even made judgment about that person. And there are times that we need to be able to be okay just not actively opposing them, letting God make his decision, because he has to be able to say, "Now I know." We sometimes want to make that decision about other individuals or other groups that God hasn't made yet. But the judgment alone is his. And we should be very grateful for that, frankly, that we don't have to make those decisions, that we don't have to make judgments about others in that way, that it's his call. And so from that standpoint, Jesus Christ tells us that really when we see these us-them scenarios, where we have these groups that are similar groups in one way or another, he says we don't have to forbid them, and we don't have to feel threatened by them. We don't have to feel like there's some big us-them battle. We just keep doing what we're doing, as he taught his disciples to do what he was doing, to follow in his work. We continue to do the work that we know that we need to do without feeling like we have to make some big dispute or big argument about it. The third story is in Luke chapter 9, verse 51. Let's go over back to Luke. You might still be in Matthew. Luke chapter 9, verse 51. So this little vignette teaches us about how to view our enemies or our opponents. So we've talked about, in the first case, we talked about sort of the polarity that can happen within a group. In the second case, we talked about the polarities that can happen between similar groups. And here we're going to talk about just the outright polarities of opposing groups. Right? These are not similar groups. These are groups that are opponents, that are enemies. The setting here is that they are now starting to move toward Jerusalem. They're heading toward Jerusalem, and that's in the south. They were in Galilee, which is sort of up in the north, right? And they're going to head toward Jerusalem. To get there, they have to pass through Samaria. Samaria is sort of this area there in the middle, and in order to get to Jerusalem, you would pass through Samaria. So they're passing through. Verse 51. Now it came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face. And as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. Now, you'll remember that the Samaritans are no friends of the Jews. Right? There was just open hostility between Samaritans and Jews. They would not eat together. They would not. They wouldn't do anything together. You remember when Jesus Christ sat down at the well with the Samaritan woman, and he asks her for water. She's surprised that he would even talk to her. That's how hostile these groups were toward each other. And there's a long history behind it. The Samaritans, if you recall, were people who had sort of been replacements for the Israelites that had been taken captive, you know, hundreds of years earlier. They had been resettled, right? The Assyrians came in and they conquered the northern kingdom of Israel. They hauled all these people off. They brought some other people back in and settled them there. And then those people kind of learned some of the ways of Israel, but they kept their ways in. They kind of kept some pagan ways in. And the Samaritans seem to have been descended from these inhabitants. So you have these people that have their own way of worshiping God, right? They thought that God should be worshiped on Mount Gerizim, not in Jerusalem. They had their other practices. The Samaritans are still a very, very small group that exists today in Israel, and they observe things very differently. Back in their day, though, there was a lot more of them, and there was a lot more hostility between them. So it's really no surprise, then, that we read in the next verse, that verse 53, it says, "But they did not receive him, because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem." Now it's explaining clearly, they did not receive him because they knew he's going to Jerusalem to worship there in a way that they didn't approve of. That wasn't how you do things. So they weren't going to receive this guy and take care of him because he's going to Jerusalem. Now, hospitality, of course, was highly regarded culturally. You were expected to be very hospitable. And so they broke that rule. But then James and John, seeing this, right, they not only do they feel slighted because these people are inhospitable, but also these people are Samaritans. These are those worthless Samaritans, these pagans that don't know how to worship God, that hate us, that work against us. We should just call down fire from heaven. And so that's what they do. Now this, and this is perhaps, if we're honest with ourselves, this is sometimes our very own raw human reaction to these situations, right? Is, wow, fire from heaven. That would solve a lot of problems right now. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did?" Elijah called down fire from heaven on a couple of captains and their troops, 50 troops, that were sent from Samaria to see him, to capture him and bring him back to the king. That's the story if you go look it up in 1 Kings. So this was kind of on their mind because they're traveling through that area where some of that would have happened. And so they think, well, hey, maybe that's a good model, right? Except there, in that story, there was an army that was actively trying to capture the prophet Elijah and take him back to the king, perhaps to be killed. Here, they were just kind of rebuffed a little, right, and not granted lodging. So it's not exactly a parallel situation. But their response was, "We're going to call down fire from heaven. Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven?" They had denied this common courtesy to the Son of God, right? And that's unacceptable. But Jesus Christ, he turned and rebuked them. Let's continue. Verse 55. He turned and rebuked them and said, "You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." And they went to another village. There were other villages around that they could go to. There wasn't a big problem here. They had to keep walking a little bit. They went to a different village. Jesus Christ had taught them earlier that if you go to a town and they won't receive you, just sort of shake the dust off and keep moving. Right? Not call fire down from heaven and keep moving. That's a very different response. If you only take one thing away from this sermon today, it's this statement that he says right here is that what I hope you'll remember. He says, "You don't know what manner of spirit you are of." When we get into these situations where we feel so heated, so at odds, so wanting to align with this camp, with this group, with this thing, because we do, our human tendency is we want to align with whatever it is that we just believe so firmly in. We have to check that. We have to check, what spirit is that of? What manner of spirit is that coming from? Let's go over to Jude, verse 17. The first and only chapter of Jude in verse 17 says, "But you, beloved, remember the words which were spoken before by the apostles of our Lord Jesus Christ, how they told you that there would be mockers in the last time who would walk according to their own ungodly lusts. These are sensual persons who cause divisions." They cause divisions. They divide things up, move people into different camps, force you to say, well, you're either part of my group or you're not. And Jude says of these people that they don't have the Spirit. It's the wrong spirit. That's the wrong spirit that that's coming from. It's what Jesus Christ teaches us. He says, you don't know what manner of spirit you're of. If you want to do that, if you want to call down fire on your enemies, or some less dramatic form of that. We don't know what spirit we're of when we want those things, when we seek those things. His perspective is that the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. Humanly, why are we so bent on bringing other people down? That seems like all you see out there on especially social media, in the news, from whatever outlet you get your news. So much of it is about bringing people down, this group, that group, bringing all these people down. But we have to take the long view. And the long view is salvation. God wants salvation for all of those people. Even the rotten ones with the rotten views. Right? He wants salvation for those people. Their time will come. There will be a day when they will be able to learn about God's way, when they won't have Satan blinding them, and they'll be able to learn these things too. That's the view he has. Is that he didn't come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. We have to be able to take that long view too. Sometimes it's challenging because it requires that we sort of hold these conflicting things in our mind, that we're able to look at somebody who may be outright opposed to God and His way and say, that is wrong. This is against God. I will never support this. But God loves that person, and someday this person could be a part of His family. It's a very hard thing to hold in mind, those two contradictions. But Jesus Christ was able to do it with so many people. He was able to see that long view and to be able to show them mercy. I want to read another article about Star Wars. This is a different article from the New York Times by Annalee Nowitz. This was released on December 24th, 2019. So it's also a little bit dated, but again, very interesting, and not really about Star Wars. A recent study by Morton Bay, a University of Southern California digital media researcher, revealed that over 50% of the venom directed on Twitter at Rian Johnson, director of The Last Jedi, came from the same resources as a Russian election meddling. I'll read that again. 50% of the venom directed at the director of The Last Jedi on Twitter came from the same sources as Russian election meddling. So it seems that it was political operatives, not fans, who were denigrating the movie and fomenting some of the virulent racism and misogyny against its cast. Using Star Wars as the vehicle was a canny move by the trolls. Fans, like the American electorate, are polarized and angry. Fascinating to me, because what they're telling us is that this isn't about Star Wars. This isn't about elections. This isn't about any of that. The goal of many of the enemies that we have out there as a nation is not to rally anyone toward a particular point of view. They're not trying to rally anybody toward this idea or toward that idea. They're trying to drive people further apart using whatever vehicle they can. Whether that's politics, whether that's something as dumb as your opinion about a Star Wars movie, they're happy to get in there and stir the pot to get people to divide up into camps. Right? Anything to get people to divide. And they're very good at it. Because look at us as a country. We're very divided. We're very polarized. Like we've taken it hook, line, and sinker. Like, oh yeah, let's start a fight about a Star Wars movie. And hundreds of thousands of people are in these camps about a movie. You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. When we get involved in that kind of thing. Right? Because that's Satan's spirit. That's not Russia. That's not whoever is drumming up all this stuff. That's Satan. That's Satan's spirit that is trying to divide humans. That's his tactic. Right? Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree in the garden? That was his tactic from the very beginning. Let's divide you up into these two sort of opposing views and just divide and conquer. That's his way of doing things. That should never be our way of doing things. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where we started. First Corinthians chapter 11, when he says, I hear that there are divisions among you, and in part I believe it. He says, for there must be factions among you, that those who are proved may be recognized. Factions is this Greek word, hieresis, which is the same root word that we get our word heresy from. He says, there must be these divisions, these heresies, these sects among you. And really, it's the simple meaning there is just choice. He's not saying there are heresies among you. He's saying there are these dividing lines among you. He's saying there are these choices. Somebody is drawing a line in the sand and saying, make a choice. That's what polarization really boils down to. Polarization is about drawing a line in the sand and forcing people to choose which side of this are you going to be on. It's giving people a choice where there should be no choice. In God's church, that's what it is. That's why we call it a heresy. Heresy is saying, I'm drawing this line in the sand, here's my pet issue, and you have to choose now. Are you going to be with me on this side of the line, or are you going to be on that side of the line? But the line should never have been drawn in the first place. There's no need to draw that line. There is no need to polarize over some trivial thing, and that's why it's called a heresy. Forcing an us and them decision over an issue that should require no choice is not something that we should be a part of. I'll give you a story. Here's a story from my work life where I fell into this trap. I was in a meeting, and somebody, I write software. And so I was in a meeting and somebody proposed, they threw this out there. They said, well, would you rather have bug-free code that had no errors and bugs in it, or would you rather have 10 times faster code? Right, which one? Which one would you want? And I immediately aligned myself into one of those particular camps and assumed that, I immediately assumed that the premise was valid, that the question was valid, right? That this was a line that should be drawn. And then I put myself in one of the camps and aligned myself under it and thought, of course this is the answer that I would go with. People who would choose this other thing are dumb. And because we like clear distinctions. When somebody will pose two things before us, we like to say, yes, A or B, black or white. Right? We don't like gray area. We don't love the middle ground. But we need to be much more comfortable, I think, with gray area. When there's not a kingdom issue at play, when there's some issue that does not break our alignment with God, Right? When there's this thing over here that people want to align you into, this thing or that thing, and our alignment is here, right? We're in our lane. We're following God's way. We're aligning ourselves under Him and thinking like Him. And somebody says, well, align yourself with these two things. Let's be comfortable with gray area. Gray area is a fine place to be when the Bible is not clear about a particular thing. And there are plenty of things that the Bible does not force us to make a decision about. Whether or not you like the last Star Wars movie is not going to help you get into the kingdom of God. We can be in the gray area there. That's a very safe place to be in the gray area. Jesus Christ, when He was confronted with issues, with questions, He often just rejected the question outright. I accepted the premise of this coding question outright. But Jesus Christ had the wisdom to recognize when a question was just a bad question that almost didn't even deserve an answer. They came and they said, well, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? And He gives them a genius answer, and it's a brilliant answer, and He doesn't answer their question. He says, well, give Caesar what's Caesar's and God what is God's. And what does that... Did He answer us? Did He tell us, yes, we should? Did He tell us, no, we shouldn't? Right? It wasn't a question. It wasn't a line in the sand that needed to be drawn. It's not about which mountain to worship on. Should we worship in Jerusalem, or should we worship in Mount Gerizim? The Samaritan woman asked Him. And He said, this is a bad question. It's not, the time's coming when it's not about whether you worship here or there. It's about whether you worship in spirit and in truth. He said, who is the greatest? Tell us, give us one. Who's the greatest guy? Who's going to be it? And He says, you should be like this child. He says, this is a bad premise. This is a bad question. We need to be able to recognize when somebody's drawing a line in the sand in front of us that just doesn't need to be there. And be able to just sort of wipe it out and keep going. Feelings of rivalry and polarization like that, those are not from God's Spirit. That's what Jesus Christ teaches us. We need to be able to ask ourselves, what manner of spirit am I of? When we find ourselves charged up about some issue, electrified about something, sometimes that's warranted, but we need to check our motives. We need to check our spirit and make sure that the thing that we are really so fired up about is really from the right spirit. This coming year, with everything that our society might throw at us, and who knows what that could be, let's not confuse man's purposes with God's purposes. Let's keep sight of God's purposes. Let's align ourselves with those purposes and avoid this whole trap of polarization.